This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, August 3rd. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Walton Arts Center, presenting The Midtown Men, four stars from the original cast of Jersey Boys, on Friday and Saturday, August 19th and 20th. This concert tour features four stars from the original cast of Broadway's Jersey Boys singing hits from the 1960s. Tickets and information are available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. On today's edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net brings us a conversation on what the new redistricting boundaries might mean in next year's election cycle. Also, Rogers adds a new event to the Frisco Festival, and Wayne Bell from FayettevilleFlyer.com stops by to discuss the state of theater in the summer. But first, 200 years ago this December, a series of massive earthquakes shook the central U.S. centered on the small town of New Madrid over a two-month period. According to eyewitness accounts, the quakes heaved the soil beneath forests, farms, and even the Mississippi River, affecting places in Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Moderate earthquakes, along with many minor quakes, continue to occur on the fault, and scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey say another destructive one is imminent. A massive earthquake drill branded the Great Central U.S. Shakeout was held this spring. But according to seismologist Seth Stein, author of Disaster Deferred, new science contradicts the hype. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently spoke with Stein on the phone.
So we're adrift on seven continents right now. And 225 million years ago, it was one single land mass identified as Pangaea. Am I saying that right? So tectonic plates beneath and above the sea are in constant shift?
Yeah. The Earth's surface is made up of plates that are about 100 miles thick, and they slide around relative to each other at about the speed your fingernails grow. So if you think about having a lake with big chunks of ice floating around on it, that's kind of what it's like. The chunks of ice are moving next to each other. And so the big earthquakes happen at the edges of these things where they slide by each other. For example, the San Andreas Fault is the boundary between the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate, and that's why we regularly have large earthquakes there.
And the New Madrid Fault.
Well, there are a lot of older faults that are kind of like cracks inside the big chunks of ice. So they don't move very much, but they do move occasionally. The problem is that they got blown up out of all proportion, sort of they became urban legends. A lot of what you hear is pretty silly. Like, you'll see over and over again this claim from the government and so on that it rang church bells in Boston. Now, that absolutely didn't happen. In fact, nobody in Boston even knew about it. Didn't kill anybody. It didn't seriously injure anybody, probably. What it did, very minor damage in places like Louisville and Nashville and St. Louis. They had a few cracked chimneys. So these were good-sized earthquakes by the standards of the middle of the continent. But they're a lot smaller than people have been saying.
So what was the magnitude of the...
About seven, which is big.
And it's been seismically active since?
Yeah, probably what we've been seeing since then are aftershocks of those earthquakes. In fact, that's how we map out the faults that we think broke in 1811, 1812. We look at the distribution of small earthquakes now and say those are aftershocks of what happened 200 years ago.
So talk about how you measure, using GPS and surface markers, how the Earth moves.
The Earth is like a spring. It stores up energy, and then it releases it. So it stores it up for a few hundred years, for 1,000 years or so, and then it releases a big earthquake. So, for example, we've been known this for about 100 years now. So we'll go to places like the San Andreas Fault and measure the two sides moving as they store up energy for the next earthquake. Or we'll do that in Oregon and Washington, see the ground storing up energy for the next earthquake. We'll do that in Japan. We'll do that in Utah and Colorado. Do that almost anywhere you can think of. The way it works is we just use GPS, because GPS can measure a position very precisely. It's to better than a millimeter. That's the width of the letters on the dime. So we started doing this in 1990 at New Madrid to see if any energy was being stored up for the next earthquake, and the answer is absolutely not. the ground isn't deforming, so the spring isn't being squeezed or stretched. So it doesn't look like there's any big earthquake on the way anytime soon.
So why are FEMA, supported by USGS and others, the Great Central U.S. Shakeout, conducted an 11-state drill where nearly 3 million people, Americans, over these states dropped, covered, and rolled?
Well, it turns out the political scientists have studied this a lot because New Madrid's fairly normal. That is, the government agencies are always coming up with these scares. You remember with Y2K, the world was going to end? People actually talked about the end of technological civilization, society would collapse. And a few years ago, we were all supposed to go out and buy duct tape and plastic sheeting to protect our houses from terrorists. And a lot of people did that. Then there were people that we were told that SARS was going to kill everybody. The last year it was swine flu was going to kill everybody. There's kind of an institutional dynamic in bureaucracies to do this. And I've done some reading in this as I was preparing my book, and there's a great quotation of someone looking at these kinds of panics. His name is Mark Siegel. He had a nice book called The Truth About the Epidemic of Fear. And he said, "Bureaucrats use fear by playing Chicken Little. They can claim at every turn that a disaster may be coming, thereby keeping their budgets high and avoiding blame should disaster really strike." In other words, it's the dynamics of the bureaucracy that produces these things. It's not really any actual geologic danger. I mean, remember, as near as we can tell, no one in the Midwest has ever been killed by an earthquake. Nobody in the Midwest has ever suffered. There's been essentially no serious damage from an earthquake, and certainly 150 years, maybe longer. So this is very, very different from California, where you have large earthquakes regularly. Buildings are damaged regularly, and people are killed, unfortunately, every few years. This is really a totally different picture here.
Then the Center for Earthquake Research and Information, which a lot of people in Arkansas refer to, on their webpage, they have posted kind of a simulation of what would occur with a 7.7 earthquake occurring in northeast Arkansas. And it says the region's undergoing east-west shortening and ancient faults along the Real Foot Rift, which is beneath New Madrid, are being reactivated to generate earthquakes. What do you have to say about that?
Might be true. I mean, it's one of the many possible things that might be causing the earthquakes. We certainly have no reason to believe that we'd see a magnitude 7.7 earthquake. I mean, that's enormously bigger than what actually happened in 1811 and 1812.
And earthquakes in the central U.S. would feel much different than earthquakes on the far west coast, yes?
They shake further because the rock is sort of more solid. It's not quite as warm. So it transmits seismic energy better.
I've read that liquefaction is part of the process on the New Madrid seismic zone. So what is that exactly?
Well, if an earthquake happens and an area is made up of sand with a lot of sort of moisture in it, loose sand, then as the sand starts to shake, the grains lose contact with each other. So the stuff can be kind of soupy. And as a result, you could have like big, you know, what are called sand blows develop in the ground and so on. And that's actually how people look at the history of the past earthquakes in the area, is looking at areas that liquefied.
Talk about earthquake predictions evolving towards earthquake forecasting.
Well, okay. The U.S. Geological Survey and other U.S. government agencies spent a lot of money in the 60s trying to predict earthquakes, and it was a complete failure. So then they said, okay, what we can do is maybe we can make longer-term forecasts, and we'll make these hazards maps. These are like the maps that show that Memphis is as dangerous as San Francisco. And when you start looking at how well those hazard maps work, the longer-term forecast, they don't work really well. I mean, they got Japan wrong, they got Haiti wrong, they got Sichuan wrong. But right now, it's not at all clear that it's doing any better than more or less just guessing.
What is the future of the New Madrid seismic zone?
I think on some time scale, thousands of years, 10,000 years, before we have anything like what happened in 1811, 1812. Certainly in anything like the next lifetime of the United States, I don't think we should be worried about a big earthquake in New Madrid. It's really exciting, based on what we've learned from GPS, to try to get to the bottom of this. So in a sense, I think arguing over whether there's a big earthquake hazard in New Madrid is silly. I think it's pretty clear that there isn't, and there isn't anything like the problem in California. I think the exciting part is the science of trying to figure out how these earthquakes in the middle of the continents work.
Seismologist Seth Stein recently spoke with Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich from his office at Northwestern University. Stein has been studying earthquakes for more than 35 years and is the author of Disaster Deferred. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Board of Apportionment met Friday morning and approved maps for all 135 redrawn legislative districts. Governor Mike Beebe and Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, the two Democrats who control the votes on the board, sided with maps presented by Beebe, while Republican Secretary of State Mark Martin voted against them. The new boundaries will force elections in all Senate and House districts in 2012. Several incumbents were moved into new districts, while others were paired against each other. The redistricting boundaries will be a big story defining next year's election cycle because they dictate which candidates will be pitted against one another. Political bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook recently discussed the issue with Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net.
You have to give it a slight edge to the Democrats. You know, the party in power pretty much draws the lines that help them a little bit, or if not a lot, when it comes to redistricting. I know that's a crazy thing to say, but you look at redistricting across the country, Republicans do it in some states, Democrats do it in others. Of course, they still have to follow the law and make sure all criteria are met, but they did draw things that kind of helped them a little bit in this upcoming election.
Right. You know, I had a political science teacher that told me, he who writes the rules controls the game. Mm-hmm. So the Democrats are going to be able to draw the map they want to draw. So obviously they're going to create the rules to their advantage. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting to me. It seems like they decided to really go for it in this map, and they're going to attempt to create a lot of competitive districts in hopes that they can hold on to the House and hold on to the Senate. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, they could have kind of fallen back and taken a safety measure to make sure they created some safe districts that they could hold. But instead, they're going for trying to keep both chambers, which could swing either way. It's kind of a gamble that could pay off and they could end up pulling it off, or it could swing the other way and they could fall back to maybe below 40% after the election cycle is over.
You know, it's going to be in 2012. I mean, it's all going to come down to legislative races. Right. Barack Obama is not going to play in Arkansas. It's not a factor. There's no Senate race. There's no gubernatorial race. There'll be congressional races, but those remains to be seen if those are going to be competitive or not. But legislative races are where it's going to be at. And the key thing for both parties, especially the Democrats, who's the one that I am more attuned to, obviously, is candidate recruitment. At the end of the day, you have to find these good candidates who are going to run hard, raise the money, and have the right message to get elected next time.
You know, I completely agree with you on the second part and disagree with you on the first part. Candidate recruitment is going to what's going to determine these races. Getting good, quality candidates, whichever party goes out and gets the best people to run, is the party that's going to win. But I do believe President Obama is going to be a huge factor. In 2012 is going to be much different than 2010. 2010, the first name people saw at the top of their screen was Governor Mike Beebe. This year, the first name they're going to see is President Barack Obama. That's the name they're going to see before they vote on these state legislative races. And I think that is going to make it extremely difficult for Democrats to win in this election cycle. They're going to be much more handicapped than they were in 2010.
Arkansans are completely different from anywhere else in the country, I think, because we have no problem with splitting the tickets. I mean, you look at 08, 04, 2000, Democrats lost the election here in Arkansas, but yet Democrats below the ticket on the legislative level won. So I think what will happen, you know, Obama is not going to win Arkansas. There's nothing he can do to win Arkansas, I don't think, unless he camps out here for the next month and a half. But I think when people will go, they'll vote against Obama, he'll lose, unfortunately. But then when it comes to legislative races, they'll look at him piece by piece, like, who do I like and whose message appeals to me? People in Arkansas have no problem differentiating between the two. A classic example being, what was it, 1968, we voted for George Wallace for president, Win Rockefeller for governor, and William Fulbright for the U.S. Senate. I mean, talk about a little bit of schizophrenia there. We have no problem of splitting our tickets.
Sure, and that's certainly been the historical trend. The question is, are we reaching a new paradigm where that's changed or not? 2010, I think, saw the beginning of that changing. Now, will the pendulum swing back to the old way it was to pre-2008, 2006, or will it continue on, as most Republicans are certainly hoping that it does? Mm-hmm. And 2010 was just a preview for 2012, which will be even bigger
year for them. Well, remains to be seen.
Exactly.
Political bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook recently spoke with Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net. Support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/small business.
Yes, come here, Nick. Hey, come.
Tony Carter calls out to Nick, her black and white border collie mix, during a visit to Murphy Dog Park in Rogers on a warm summer evening. At Carter's feet rests her other dog.
This is Rose, and Rose is a blue heeler, and she's kind of hot. She doesn't really like to come out very much, so she's been in the air conditioning. Right now is a good time to run my big dog, though, Nicky. He loves to run, and he has to run about 20 minutes a day, or he is just not a happy camper.
Carter explains Nick has learned some tricks, one of which will be on display during the inaugural Frisco Festival Dog Show August 27th. Carter is an activist who works with dog rescue throughout Northwest Arkansas, and she is helping spread the word about this new event.
All of the dogs that we're going to help support through this pet show, though, are city shelter dogs. So it's the Animal Services of Rogers that's going to benefit from the $10 registration. The Humane Society has lots of things that go on, but this is the first time that the city shelter has really stepped out. So we're hoping to support them through the individual dog registrations. It's $10 to register your dog. You can pick up a form at the City of Rogers. You can call me at 631-9909, and I will send you one. Lots of the vets are going to have them, and we're just hoping that people can understand that costs are ongoing at shelters. The city shelter has to pay for gas when they take dogs out for adoption days, little incidentals, things like baby formula for some of the kittens and puppies and things like that.
Carter helps run Murphy Dog Park, which is located next to the Humane Society for Animals in Rogers. Carter has been involved with the organization for about 6 years and says oftentimes people don't realize there's a difference between the Humane Society and the City of Rogers Animal Shelter.
They get us confused all the time, and they always call us the Pound. Either place is often called the Pound. We don't like to call it that anymore. We like to call the Humane Society the Adoption Center. The City Services for Animals is another way to call the city shelter. The city shelter picks up animals within the city limits. Humane Society picks up animals in all of Benton County. So we extend from one point to way over to Siloam. And it's just grown enormously. Lots of people get the wrong dog when they move to the country. They'll think, oh, I'm moving to the country, I can get, you know, a great big dog. And it just doesn't always work that way. We have rules in the county and in the city.
The dog show, which will be located at Centennial Park in downtown Rogers, will have an early start time.
It's going to start at 9, and it'll be over by 10:30, so the dogs won't get so hot. And they're going to try and be, you know, very dog-friendly. There'll be lots of water, there'll be some pools, and there'll be places for the dogs to cool off.
Although the event will be in Rogers, Carter says dogs from throughout the region may take part in the show.
Any dog can participate. We're hoping that Washington County will send some of their awesome dogs down. We want to extend a little bit of a challenge. We want to see how cute the Washington County dogs are. We don't think Benton County dogs can be beat. There'll be shelter dogs there. There'll be individuals that are, individual dogs that are owned by just regular people. My dog, Nick, will be competing in the best trick. And we want, all people who have little bitty dogs to great big dogs to come down.
After owners showcase their pets, three judges will select winners from several different contests.
Some of the categories are cutest dog, that is for the littlest dog under 20 pounds, most adorable medium dog, that takes in a lot of the dogs, best looking big dog. So if you've got an awesome Irish Wolfhound or a Great Dane, please bring them down. Best dog trick, so work on your tricks. Best doggy costume. You might want to dress your dog up like a hot dog. There'll be lots of hot dogs down there. Dog and owner look-alike. Best in show. And the I'm so ugly, I'm cute winner. Lots of dogs can qualify for that.
The event is being sponsored by Central Garden and Pet.
Central Garden and Pets has done us a great service. Central Garden and Pets out of Bentonville. Amazing, amazing donations. We have got the best prizes. Dogs can win ribbons, first place, second place, and third place. And but Central Garden and Pets has donated all kinds of pet items. They've donated gift baskets. The city, the downtown merchants, I think, are donating some cash. So who knows? I mean, who knows what kind of amazing prizes there's going to be? It's not until August 27th. There's plenty of time, and we just hope that everybody will come out and join us.
The inaugural Frisco Festival Dog Show will begin at 9 a.m. August 27th in downtown Rogers. Proceeds will benefit the City of Rogers Animal Shelter. The $10 entry fee covers all dogs owned by one person. More information is available at friscofestival.com. It's Wednesday, August 3rd. Joining me now is Becca Bacon Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
So there are fun things to do.
Perfect.
Including at 1 o'clock, Upstage Melodrama. Teen volunteers present the search for the secret book of Atrebor.
Huh.
At 1 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. Dreamweavers, a loom knitting group for teens and tweens, is at 2 at the Boone County Library in Harrison.
Okay.
And at 7:30 tonight, in the Reynolds Room of the Smith Pendergraph Campus Center at the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith, a show called Versailles Chateau and Gardens, a Military Theme Park. This is a multimedia presentation with UAFS students who traveled abroad with Stephen Husarek, the professor.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember we had a really interesting performance
yes.
with him last year. I haven't the foggiest idea what this one is about, but I'll bet you it's interesting. And it starts at 7:30, and it's free, and it's air-conditioned.
Yay for air conditioning.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The 16th annual Ozark Guidance Golf Tournament is Monday, August 22nd at the Springdale Country Club. The registration deadline is Monday, August 15th, and a variety of sponsorship levels are still available. Proceeds to benefit mental health services for children and families. More information and registration are available on the web at ozarkguidance.org. The National Weather Service has issued another excessive heat warning for the entire KUAF listening area. Record high temperatures mixed with high humidity are creating dangerous daytime heating with little respite at night. Yesterday, Fort Smith tied an all-time heat record of 113 degrees set in 1936. Fayetteville reached 108, 2 degrees shy of a 1954 record. And it could be even hotter today. Pete Snyder, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Tulsa, said a high-pressure ridge very high in the atmosphere is compressing and cycling heat over the region.
Sometimes we see this occur every, every 50 years or so. You'll get a pattern like this that'll set up, and it just persists all summer long, and that's what's happening.
Utilities continue to operate at peak capacity and request customers conserve energy. Carroll Electric reported several outages yesterday in extreme northwest Arkansas. An excessive heat warning will remain in effect through Friday, with an excessive heat watch through Monday evening. This is Ozarks at Large. The KUAF Summer Jazz Series continues Saturday with the Composer's Showcase. This week, Robert Ginsberg, host of Shades of Jazz, is bringing us a series of interviews with those involved with the event. Last week, he spoke with Ben Harris, who is not only a musician performing at Saturday's event, but also this year's musical director.
Ben Harris, as many of you know, is one of our fine resident jazz musicians who moved up from New Orleans a few years back, right?
Sort of. I was from Little Rock. I had just moved to New Orleans, and then Katrina came through, so we went back to Little Rock. And spent about a year there just trying to, pick up the pieces and figure out what we were going to do before we finally relocated to Fayetteville.
And Ben, you play in a number of ensembles, not the least of which is the Fayetteville Jazz Collective.
Mm-hmm.
And you've kind of taken on the role there as the front man, too. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, I have a lot of fun with that. That's a good outlet for me.
But you've also played with just about every jazz musician in the area,
mm-hmm.
really in the state in some cases, the time you've spent in Little Rock, mm-hmm. and now you also own a agency, right?
Booking agency, right?
Right.
Porter Jones Entertainment.
Mm-hmm. And most importantly to me, Ben, you have taken on the role as the musical director for the KUAF's Summer Jazz Concert Composer Showcase.
Right.
And that is no small task. Why don't you kind of describe to folks what the Composer Showcase is going to be this year?
Well, it's, as always, as every year, it's a concert where the local jazz musicians get to get up in a great venue, in a great room, the Star Theater at the Walton Arts Center, and present their music as they imagine it, which is different than what we usually get to do on most gigs that we play, where we're playing jazz standards and things like that that people will recognize. This is the one night of the year when it's all about us, and we get to do our music our way, and it's just a really special thing.
No TV sets behind you, no bar,
no
glasses.
Dart boards, no pool tables.
And original music, original
mm-hmm.
compositions.
Mm-hmm.
And the lineup this year is pretty interesting. Can you kind of run mm-hmm. down some of the performers?
Right. We're going to have Matt and Gus Smith. They're going to open the show with Al Gibson and I believe Ken Everts, and I'm not sure who plays bass with them.
Drew Packard is going to play.
Sitting in on bass. Jim Greason's Hogtown Hot Club. They're going to be on the bill. And who else? Claudia Burson Trio, of course, will be there. As you said, the Fayetteville Jazz Collective is going to be playing some new stuff. Walter Savage will be on the bill. Nathan McLeod's going to have a couple of things with a combo. And then we also have the Scholarship Alumni All-Star Recipient Band. We may have to shorten that.
Somehow. How are they going to list that in the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, I don't know. That's not going to work.
Well, I can talk a little bit about that. These are students who are no longer students. A lot of them are professional jazz musicians that became scholarship recipients which is part of the program that the North Arkansas Jazz Society does every summer. They award scholarships to kids that are studying music that want to further their studies. Typically, they're sent to the Jamie Abersold Summer Jazz Camp. And so we're putting together a band which is mostly, if not all, former scholarship recipients. So that'll mm-hmm. be fun, too. Mm-hmm. And I think Drew Packard is kind of leading
Drew's
that.
Drew's kind of running that.
Mm-hmm. So a great lineup. It's kind of, you hear the joke all the time about trying to get jazz musicians to do what you want is like herding cats. So. But this is your second year as musical director for this. And
mm-hmm. I've had a lot of cat herding experience with with the Jazz Collective, especially.
I'll bet.
That's, with 18 people, it's a real challenge to get everybody in the same place at the same time and focused on the same agenda. It's no small endeavor.
No, and really, you guys have done a great job.
We just celebrated our second anniversary in June.
Okay, so it's over 2 years the Fayetteville Jazz Collective has been together. A lot of people have heard you. You've played a lot of venues. You've been on the stage at the Walden Arts Center. Mm-hmm. You play regularly, like once a month, at the
UARC Ballroom.
UARC Ballroom. Prior to that, I know you did some gigs at Scarpino's, and you're getting work, it sounds like.
We are. We've played in a church parking lot. We played on the front porch of a house in Bentonville one time. We've been all over the place. No job too big or too small.
Well, and this, you know, that ensemble, first of all, there's nothing like hearing that wall of sound, a jazz orchestra. Yeah. But what I really love about what you guys are doing is you're not only doing a lot of the standard repertoire, but not unlike the Composer Showcase, there's some really good composers that are part of that group. Rick Salonon comes to mind. And you're doing some original tunes and original arrangements as well.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have somebody like Rick Salonon in the band because he's just such a great composer and arranger and just such a great musician. And, you know, everybody just has such a high regard for Rick and what he's able to do. And it's crazy that he... Every chart that he brings in is a little bit better than the last one. It's like he's continually getting better, which is kind of scary because he's already he's just so good at it. And we're really happy to occasionally get to play the music of Jim Greeson as well because so many of us were students of his.
So we've got solos, quartet, quintet, big band, all this coming up August 6th in Star Theater at the Walden Arts Center. And Ben, I want to give you a chance to showcase some of your fine musicianship if I could twist your arm to play a tune for us.
Sure.
Why don't you set this up?
Well, let's see. I'll do one that I've written that's fairly new. It's still kind of a work in progress. This is the working title of this is Open Strings.
Very nice, Ben. There's a lot going on there. I hear almost a bossa nova or a Brazilian sound at the head, but then it moves off in several different directions. It's very interesting, too.
Thank you.
Ben, thanks again.
Thanks for having me. It's a blast.
Robert Ginsberg, the host of Shades of Jazz, spoke with Ben Harris last week. More information about the KUAF Summer Jazz Series can be found at digjazz.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Our content partner, WKNO in Memphis, has produced a series on little-known facts about the history of rock and roll. Today, the series continues with Rob Grayson's story about a lonely street.
I walk a lonely street. A five-word goodbye note addressed to no one. No ID on the victim, so the author of that efficient summation of a life of quiet desperation remains a mystery. Not unnoticed and not forgotten, though, as the song the five words inspired haunts us to this day. Songwriter Tommy Durden spotted the article in the newspaper, the Miami Herald. He shared the sad story with his writing partner, May Axton. May decided the lonely street should have a gathering place for lost souls, and using words and meter in place of bricks and mortar, built the Heartbreak Hotel. May Axton was born in Texas, studied journalism in Oklahoma, where incidentally her son was born, according to song, and taught school at Paxson High in Jacksonville, Florida. Axton also dabbled in radio, television. As a matter of fact, this is May interviewing Elvis Presley, and handled public relations and concert promotion. That put her in touch with Colonel Tom Parker, who was running the show for country singer Hank Snow. Axton added the up-and-coming rockabilly singer from Memphis as the opening act for a Hank Snow show in May of 1955. At the concert, Elvis teased the 14,000 fans attending with, "Girls, I'll see you backstage." The ensuing riot was the proverbial hard act to follow for Hank Snow and got the undivided attention of Colonel Parker. Following that show, May Axton also made a claim which would rival the sports equivalents of Babe Ruth's called shot against the Cubs in the World Series or Joe Namath's guarantee of a Super Bowl victory. May told Elvis she would write his first million seller. After fleshing out Heartbreak Hotel, Axton and Durden had a local country singer, Glenn Reeves, record the demo of the song.
Oh, since my baby left, I found a new place to dwell.
Axton presented the song to Elvis at the November 1955 Country Music Disc Jockeys Convention in Nashville. She was quoted as saying Elvis' reaction to the tune was, "Hot dog, May." Once he found his musical niche, Elvis was a legend in Memphis and across the South. Sun Records had already been basking in the glow of his first singles, but their limited distribution and promotion could only get him so far. By August of 1955, Elvis was Colonel Parker's sole client, and the consummate showman put all his efforts into securing a larger stage for his young ward. Passing up the interest shown by Columbia and Atlantic Records, Colonel Parker used his existing contacts with RCA Records, who bought Presley's contract from Sun Records for $35,000, plus an additional $5,000 for back royalties. So in January of 1956, 2 days after his 21st birthday, Elvis headed for RCA's recording studios in Nashville. Producer Steve Sholes would team the existing Presley band, Scotty Moore, Bill Black, and DJ Fontana, with session pros Chet Atkins, Floyd Kramer, and singers Ben and Brock Spear and Gordon Stoker. The sessions were tense, but the home office expecting an immediate and impressive return on their investment. The assembled group warmed up on Ray Charles' I Got a Woman, and then put down seven takes of Heartbreak Hotel. The suits in New York didn't like the tapes that came from the sessions. They felt whatever lightning Sam Phillips caught at Sun in Memphis wasn't translating well in Nashville. After deciding against re-recording the song, Take 7 of Heartbreak Hotel became Elvis's first RCA single. Released in January, the record that worried the RCA executives had, by April, hit number one. It stayed there for 8 weeks. May Axton would write more than 200 songs, recorded by artists such as Perry Como, Farron Young, Conway Twitty, and Patsy Cline. Her son Hoyt wrote a few songs too, like Joy to the World, the Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog one, not the Christmas one, and Never Been to Spain, which was covered live by Elvis. In Memphis, I'm Rob Grayson.
Rob Grayson from our content partner WKNO filed that story from Memphis. Joining me now is Wayne Bell, author of The Culture Club, found in FayettevilleFlyer.com. Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. You look so different today, Kyle.
Yes, I am in for Kyle today, but we are still going to talk about pop culture and such this weekend. Crazy Stupid Love came out at the theaters, and it's a little different from what you typically find during the summer at the theaters.
Well, the big movies this past weekend, it looked like, were Cowboys and Aliens with Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig. And Smurfs, the movie, which actually, I think, when it's all said and done, might have won the weekend, which pleases me.
It pleases you.
As a man of the 80s, but...
That's fair.
I did go see Crazy Stupid Love because it had been marketed as kind of an adult comedy, a comedy that attracted to an older demographic, post-25. And I was surprised. It's really well written. It's well acted. Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone and Steve Carell and... Marissa Tomei and Julianne Moore. It's smart, sexy, witty, and it got me thinking about why these films don't get made more during the summer, because I don't tend to go a lot during the summer to see, you know, the big action movies. But every summer, whether it be last summer with The Kids Are All Right or a couple of years ago with Little Miss Sunshine, these movies that appeal to adults come out and they do very well. And you know, they're movies that I think our listeners really respond to. But for whatever reason, they get pushed aside for blockbusters.
Why do you think it is that the summertime is full of superheroes and explosions? And
well, apparently people past the age of 25, women and minorities, don't exist in the summer. It's just young 18-year-old boys.
Right.
You know, if you look at this past summer... I would say Crazy Stupid Love is the best and most well-written, well-acted of the films. But from Bridesmaids to Bad Teacher to Friends with Benefits, all these movies that came out did pretty well with adult audiences.
Right.
It's just they're not, you know, they don't have a 4 in the title or an 8 or Revenge of. And you look at something like Pirates of the Caribbean, it's come and gone. You look at them all and you can just kind of lump them together because even with Harry Potter, they had a huge opening weekend and then a huge fall off. These movies do really well on the opening weekend, these big blockbusters, and then they die. Whereas these smaller films that, you know, appeal to adults, they have staying power. Kids Are All Right pretty much stayed around for most of last year, you know, based on good word of mouth. Little Miss Sunshine started really small and stayed around for the whole year and in the conversation.
And it's kind of interesting, those two movies that you mentioned also feature Julianne Moore and Steve Carell, who are in Crazy Stupid Love.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about it. And I will say that when we left Crazy Stupid Love, I'm not giving anything away.
Okay.
It says in the preview that, you know, Julianne Moore is unhappy in her marriage to Steve Carell and she wants to leave. And, you know, I was sitting here going, this is her new role. And a lot of these movies that she's been doing lately, she's this, you know, this adulteress or an alcoholic, or she's just really good at tragically flawed women. But it really has proven that, you know, Steve Carell is way beyond The Office now.
Yes.
And, you know, and then it shows us people that, you know, we may not have appreciated in the past, like Emma Stone or Marissa Tomei or Ryan Gosling, doing really excellent work.
There's definitely an audience for those big blockbuster movies. Do you think it would be better if they spread it out throughout the year?
I would love
better?
It. I think it would two prongs, spread it out throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And of course, the reason they don't is because kids are out of school.
Do you think that maybe some of these movies that are more appealing to adults kind of are afraid to put themselves in during the summer? Because I know a lot of the more people that want to be taken more seriously tend to come out in the fall.
Well, yeah, they come out in the fall and around Christmas for the Oscars.
So,
you know, it's kind of like, well, maybe if something like Crazy Stupid Love came out in November or December, it would get lost amongst those movies.
Fair.
Because it's not serious. No one... I'm not giving anything away. No one dies of cancer.
No, it's not like super dramatic.
No one has to learn how to overcome their speech impediment to address the people of England. So, you know, it could be lost during that, too. But, yeah, I mean, I think they probably are a little bit afraid, but there's really nothing to lose now, because I would argue that the core demographic for Fast and Furious 5 or, you know, something like that is completely different than Crazy Stupid Love.
Now, see, I don't remember a time when summer didn't involve explosions and superheroes or cartoons or wizards.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a time where this was not, summer was not necessarily just the blockbuster? I mean, when did that change?
Well, I think it started to really change in the late 90s, because in the mid 90s, you still had stuff that would come out and it was a huge epic movie like A Lion King or Forrest Gump, or even, you know, Jurassic Park to some extent, even though I do know that, you know, that's a big franchise. It wasn't then.
Right.
And then in the late 90s, it started to become Will Smith summers. So it was Independence Day or
Men in Black
or Wild Wild West. And he started coming out with these epic movies every summer. And then they started to one-up themselves and other people started to get in on it. And I think that really took hold in the late 90s. And now, you know, the summers are so saturated.
So what do you think needs to be done in order for that to change?
Well, adults are going to have to show, you know, attendance at these smaller movies in record numbers. But I don't see it changing, because, you know, the summer is seen as that period where, you know, the school year's out or work is less and you can kind of dumb down and, you know, lose some brain cells in the heat. And as it stands right now, you know, that's what we have. But you can still look forward to, I know next summer is The Dark Knight Rises.
Yes.
Last summer was Inception. Mm-hmm. You can have smart, big movies. So if they're not going to change the format and they're still going to do big action movies, at least make them smart. At least put an extra 10 minutes into your story, because, you know, there may be a lot of teenagers in the audience, but a lot of parents are in there too. And so why do we have to dumb everything down?
So you're probably done watching movies for the summer.
I'm probably done until about September, October. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping by. Wayne Bell is the author of The Culture Club, found at FableFlyer.com. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Time now for a trivia question. And today's winner will receive 4 tickets to see Reverend Horton Heat playing at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville on Thursday at 8 o'clock. Earlier in the show, we discussed the Frisco Festival adding a dog show to its event, its lineup this year. And that got me to thinking about the Westminster Kennel Club, their dog show. It's a big one you see every year and it's on TV. So my question today is, when they had the dog show earlier this year, what breed of dog won best in show? Was it a Scottish Deerhound, a Cocker Spaniel, or a Basset Hound? If you have a guess or if you know the answer, give me a call at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF, and good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 3rd of August, 2011. It's the birthday of Carrie Barry, born in Atlanta, 1854. She was just 7 years old when the Civil War began. She kept a diary. And from her diary, which is very sweet, even in the midst of terrifying events, we can know more about everyday life in the South. She writes about General Sherman's march to the sea and the burning of Atlanta. And she also writes about school and studying arithmetic, spelling, reading, and geography, and how her teacher, Miss Maddie, told the children that they knew their multiplication tables very, very well. It was on this day, 1527, the first known letter from the New World to the Old was sent to King Henry VIII of England by his sea captain, Master John Rutt, who Henry had sent to command an expedition to North America in search of the Northwest Passage to Asia. He was on a boat called the Mary Guildford. It had a rough crossing of the Atlantic. It explored the coast of Labrador and then came into harbor at the port of St. John's on Newfoundland, where on August 3rd, Master Rutt wrote to King Henry VIII that we found many great islands of ice and deep water. The expedition had gone out on the mistaken belief that no matter how far north you sailed, seawater could not possibly freeze. And John Rutt was finding that this was not true. There in the harbor of St. John's, he found 11 Norman fishing boats, one from Britain and two from Portugal. And he turned his boat to the south, and he sailed toward Florida. It was on this day, 1841, Juliana Horatia Ewing was born in the village of Ecclesfield in Yorkshire, England. She loved to make up stories for her siblings based on Hans Christian Andersen and the Grimm brothers. She wrote plays for her siblings. When she was 18, she founded a lending library and then began her publishing career, writing stories for magazines. Her book, The Brownies and Other Tales, was very popular, practically unknown today, but immensely popular in her time. And the founders of the Girl Scout movement named their junior-level scouts Brownies in honor of her. Here's a poem for today by Marianne Larkin, The Last Summer. The children know it, the way they call to each other, the way they gather to trim the branches, as at old rituals, their gentleness. When we were young, they say. The father, stooped as they are straight, goes from one to another, names them, consults the dog's leg, some car trouble, always an object between them. He sits among them this summer in his old T-shirt. His body absorbs them. The mother laughs often this summer, teases their friends. My daughter gave me, my son helped me, she tells me. She spins around them, ties up her plants, has them paint and paper. She thinks it'll be nice for them. There may be a wedding, who knows, 5 still at home, but not for long. She is the bravest. She says it, if only to herself. It is the last summer, she says. It is the last summer. The Last Summer, poem by Marianne Larkin from The Coil of the Skin, published by Washington Writers Publishing House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Priscilla Kinter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time now for an answer to today's trivia question. Before Writer's Almanac, I asked this year at the Westminster Kennel Club's annual dog show, which breed of dog won best in show? Was it a Scottish Deerhound, a Cocker Spaniel, or a Basset Hound? The answer is a Scottish Deerhound. We will place the names of everyone who called in with the correct answer into the ceramic cow and draw a winner for Reverend Horton Heat tickets in just a minute. Ozarks at Large is brought to you in part by CertaPro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting needs, including interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information are available at 1-800-GO-CERTA or CertaProPainters.com. Support is also provided by Bordino's Restaurant and Wine Bar on Dixon in Fayetteville, offering lunch and dinner menus using seasonal, locally grown produce. The first seating menu is available on Monday evenings from 5 to 6:30, Tuesday through Saturday. Reservations, drink menus, and more available at Bordino's.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Frisco. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Have a good day.